Pickles. Everybody, welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian Wimpen and William Tincup coming to you live every day, talking about human resources with the people that are out there getting it done. So, well, let's get into it, William. So, I just have a comment for you that I saw a little post on this on the Facebooks last night, something about signing day. Got some talent coming up in college football ranks and seem to feel there's only like one team, one conference in the whole country. It's weird.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up on me. There is do you think there's other conferences in college football?
It's 2013. Things changed.
Mm-hmm.
They lost all their talent. It was a three shot wonder.
You guys, Tim Sackick and I have been going back on this, back and forth on this all day long, and we've seeded tennis and baseball and badminton and the chess club and maybe even debate to all the other school districts and or conferences. The truth is football, there is only one conference in college football. And 8 out of 14 championships, at one point people were just kind of like, yeah, fair enough, all right. Football is over here, and we could go and get really good at basketball and maybe win some championships or something. So what's Nebraska going to be good at next is probably what you need to be solving for.
Oh, we're on the mend. It'll be fun. So, I mean, Sackett's he's up in Michigan, so there's not a lot I can – and where he's a Big Tenner, so I'll support him, but it's – you know, we got a little ways to go. So, but anyway, it'll be a fun year to see what unfolds with that. And I just wanted to get that out there. Start early.
Yeah.
Start early.
Fair
statement. So, we're good at wrestling. We're really good at wrestling, by the way. That's a good one. And very, very good at our women's volleyball team is one of the best in the country. So, we got sports. Anyway, let's get to our guests. Before the awkward silence gets any louder. So, Adam Robinson, welcome to Drive Through HR.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So, actually, let's kick it off. Let's jump right in because I know you've got some interesting things to share, kind of where you're at with things, and introduce yourself, and then we'll kind of roll into what's top of mind.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Appreciate you having me on. Like you said, my name is Adam Robinson, as far as I know. I am the co-founder and CEO of Hireology. We're a Chicago-based, early-stage talent technology platform that uses data and some tools we've built to help organizations make better hiring choices.
And Adam, this is William. What's keeping you up at night these days, brother? What's top of mind for you as we start off 2013?
Well, you know, 15 years in HR and in the talent space, I don't think there has ever been a crazier time where change has been faster, more vendors have been in the market, more companies are reevaluating their strategic use of HR and technology, and I mean, it is an awesome time to be in this space. It's also a scary time to be in this space, and you know what was important 2 years ago is now something people generally aren't talking a whole lot about. Now it's shiny object over here. I think we're just flying faster than we ever have before as an industry. It's great, but there's not a lot of downtime.
How do you differentiate? How do you when you're kind of talking to people that might not know either your company or your brand or things like that? How do you differentiate to folks? How do you cut through the noise?
Well, I mean, the question I always try to ask when we talk to customers is, you know, how's that working for you now? And, you know, what we see is, you know, you've got a market completely saturated with HR technology products and not a lot of solutions out there. So we've got an industry full of point solutions, and then we've got a couple of giant vendors that are competing over the top 5% of the market. And, you know, there's this huge slice of the market that's really not having the problem solved. So you've got big companies that invest $1 million a year in an HR technology stack that doesn't solve the real problem, which we think is, how do, you know, which person should I hire? That's the question. The point of all this stuff we do is to put the right person in the right seat. You know, but we've got solutions that can give you 5,000 resumes in half a second. I can automated survey everybody that applies to a job. I can ship them all to a system that does stuff after I hire them. I can give one of 10,000 tests to somebody, find out if they're an optimist. You know, these are all good things, but I think in a piecemeal solution don't solve the problem. And what we're finding is that companies have one of lots of these things, and they're still picking the wrong people half the time. And where we come in is we say, okay, great, you've got all this data you've collected. You have a great resume sourcing engine, candidate sourcing engine, and lots of great tools that make that easier. Do you know what your managers are saying in interviews? And, you know, generally at that point people start chuckling. You know, no, they completely make it up as they go. And that's really where we see the next big thing is, how do you take all this data we have and use it to predict whether John Smith is going to be a good salesperson for your field operation or not? You know, that's the solution I think our industry aspires to. And everything else out there in the vendor landscape supports the data that goes into making that decision, and then that person once they become an employee. But that decision point is the next big thing for HR technology, and we're glad to be right on the point of that.
Let's talk a little bit about the DNA of a great hire. What are the, in your, you know, vast experience, what's the elements that makes up the DNA of a great hire? Not a good hire, not a, you know, what do they say, bums in seats or whatever the heck, not filling a job, but what the DNA of a great hire, what is that?
Yeah, great question. Well, there are four things. We you know, track this, you know, research it, report on this across all of our customers. There are four things we call, we actually call them super elements. They are things that have been present in a candidate in all cases, no matter what the job is, predict a higher likelihood of success, and, you know, a top 20%er, let's call them, in terms of performance. You guys ready for the fourth thing?
You bet. Bring it.
Here they are. The first one is a documented track record of success in prior jobs. That's the resume. Most companies use the resume for nearly 100% of the decision. What did you do and how did you do it and who did you do it for? Reading a resume, that's a quarter of the decision. I think people really overweight that. That's generally, as you know, lots of people know, a great marketing document that you really have to dig into. But the important thing to think through as you're reading through a resume is, did this candidate do what we're going to ask them to do, and did they have a support structure and an environment that matches ours? So, as you know, we can say what made them successful in job A is going to make them successful in our job. And where people get into trouble is, you know, the proverbial, high growth young company that wants the superstar from the big vendor to come own their sales operation. So they go get the best person out of the big company and put them in their small company. Well, over half the time our data shows that person fails to meet expectations, and the reason is not because of the skill set. The reason is because what made them successful doesn't exist in your small company. So name ID, pricing power, a marketing department, a trade show budget, all of these things sure do make it easier for salespeople to win and be successful. And, you know, the model of a person, the resume of a person in a smaller company, you know, you don't have all that stuff. you know, you got to figure it out. You've got to improvise and do a lot more with a lot less. And, you know, people looking for talent first need to ask that question, is what made this person successful, what I have to offer them here? And if the answer is no, you've just really increased the risk that you're going to have a bad outcome. So that would be the first thing. The second thing would be, and again, generally understood, a culture fit. And the way we describe that is, you know, the degree to which a candidate exhibits the cultural norms and behaviors and value system of the company. It's a little soft and sometimes a legal gray area to measure it. But what we find is that managers, if they really pay attention and think it through, they know whether that candidate is a fit. And when it's not a fit, you know, the best performing person that's a bad culture fit, you know, equals a real big problem. So that's the second. The other two, the first one is a term a lot of people are familiar with. We call it locus of control. It's a sense of accountability. So, you know, what we see as predicting higher levels of success, people with an internal locus of control versus external. And so it's easier than you think to pick this out of a conversation. People with an internal locus of control will say things like, you know, I guess I should have done a better job understanding what you wanted from me, and I'm sorry I didn't deliver that, right? I should have asked better questions. I guess I didn't know what the customer was really looking for, right? Internal locus of control. I attribute the outcomes to my actions versus an external locus of control, which would be, you didn't tell me that's what you wanted. The economy was bad. Our company's pricing was too high. All of those things, you know, in the sales example, would indicate somebody that attributes outcomes to some outside factor, not in their control. People with an internal locus of control are overwhelmingly more likely to be successful in any job because they own the result. That is a huge predictor of success in this, you know, superstar candidate model we're talking about. The fourth is we've got culture fit, we've got sense of accountability, we've got prior track record of success, and here on the spot, I'm drawing a blank on the board.
No worries. Let me ask you, because I do have a follow-up. What? How do you tell, how do you measure if someone's hungry? Not hunger in terms of food, but hunger in terms of ambition. How do you measure that? How do you get a sense on whether or not that person, if everything else checks out, how do you gauge whether or not they're truly hungry?
You know, it comes down to asking good questions and really digging into the answer. So a test, you know, or assessment can tell you, you know, where somebody will self-assess themselves on that scale. And generally, you know, those are helpful. But the most predictive thing you can do is just ask the question. And, you know, I'll give you a couple examples of that. I mean, you know, when one of our customers sits down with an interviewee, one of the things we want to start off on a first conversation is just ask, you know, the biggest possible picture question. At the end of your career, you know, what will you have accomplished? You know, walk me through, you're walking out the door, it's the last day, you're flipping the light switch, you're taking your plant with you, high-fiving, you got the cake party, what have you done? And, you know, it's a great question because it's really, it's not a threatening question. It's a great way to establish trust, but it also gives your candidate an unvarnished opportunity to just tell you what expectations they've set for themselves. And so, you know, if you're talking with an entry-level or early career person that's got huge dreams and is really very clearly set out a plan for themselves, you know, that's a good data point. On the other hand, someone that really hasn't thought about it is generally not likely to be someone who thinks about that kind of stuff. And so it doesn't mean they're going to be a bad fit. It just means that it's not a priority in how they consider opportunities. You know, mid-career or later stage career folks, you know, the best performers tend to have a very concrete vision for what they want to get done by the time they're done. And we can point to that in the data. And then the follow-up is very simply, you know, a version of, okay, well, what are you going to do in the next 12 months to get there? And you get a real a real good sense of this is my plan and this is what I'm going to do this year to get there. It's just a great opening to just about any job conversation.
Well, you can't have a team of a basketball team of five Michael Jordans. So I'm assuming that there's a difference between the key players, the value adders, and leaders. First of all, challenge all of that, whether or not that is true or not. Do you all separate between the people that are going to come in and have a lot of impact and assess for that and kind of the DNA of what those folks are like, and then the DNA of people that really are going to be the leaders of the organization? And do you separate between the two? And if so, what does that world look like?
I would say it is possible to have an all-star in every role. It absolutely is possible. But what makes someone an all-star executive suite leader is not the same thing that makes someone an all-star marketing coordinator or inside sales representative. But there's a certain set of criteria that makes an all-star for a certain position. And, you know, my favorite definition of all-star or A player, you know, whatever you want to call it, Jeff Smart, you know, of Top Grading fame and Smart and Associates defined an A player the best way I've heard it defined. If this person is in the top 10% of all available talent at that compensation level. And so, you know, if you think about that, it makes so much sense. You know, we're paying $50,000 a year for this position. We want to get the top 10% of everyone available at that salary range for this job. That's your all-star. You know, if we can't afford to pay 50, we can only pay 40. All right, who's the 10%er at the 40K range? Does a top 10%er at 50K get us what we want? No? Well, then we probably need to bring it up a salary level or two. But at any salary level, it is possible to get a top 10%er in that position, and that's what we should all aspire to as hiring managers. There is a pool. You want to be on the far right end of that bell curve. It takes a little longer. It's a little harder. You need to be a little more rigorous in your process. But, you know, would you rather fall asleep at night wondering how the heck that person got hired and what you're going to do to get rid of them, or would you rather sleep at night knowing you've got the best team in your business? You know, it's worth the extra time.
Adam, great narrative thus far. Do a quick reset, everybody. Listening to Drive Through HR, Ryan and William on with Adam Robinson. Let's kind of going to go a different, just a little bit of different way, and get your take on how people trying to measure social, kind of their people's social acumen, like social acumen around social networking, technology, kind of where that's playing into, and being an influencer, kind of just that whole talk track. How companies you're seeing your clients perceive that, and how you being on the kind of the assessment side of the world are thinking about that as from a screening and selection perspective?
Yeah, great question. My short answer, and then I'll jump in with the fourth thing that your question kicked me in the rear, and now I remember. The degree to which that stuff is important is job dependent, is my answer. I mean, to a certain degree, you need to, as a member of the workforce in the age in which we live, you've got to be aware of these tools and be able to navigate them, because I think, you know, we're on probably the year two of a 5-year cycle of having social tools, invade the enterprise. So collaboration and the tools that the B2C world has made so popular are really, it's the front end of that being a B2B workplace norm. So people need to know how to do that. That's a skill just about everyone needs. So I think just to get by, you know, 5 years from now, if you don't know how to play that game and don't have the social norms and you just can't think strategically about your online relationships, whether it be at work or outside, you know, you're really going to be behind. I don't know someone coming into the workforce that hasn't had that skill since they were 12, honestly. So, you know, that problem is going to fix itself. I think what becomes interesting is as talent moves up the value chain for an organization, you know, in roles like business development or marketing, being an evangelist for a brand, being a leader of an organization, you know, being able to extract value from that skill set becomes really important. I don't know that it's a must-have. I think it's a real value add. You know, people are coming with their own brand, their own following. It's good and it's bad in lots of ways. And you know, measuring it's increasingly easy. You just kind of look at the behavior and look at the frequency and see what the dialogue looks like. There are ways to spot check that stuff, number of connections, yeah. You know, social
nice.
Velocity, all that stuff. The fourth thing, the fourth super element, we've all been waiting for it, is attitude. And this really plays into this. You know, research shows, lots of different big meta research has shown that people with a positive attitude tend to be better performers at work. You know, that in general, the research, you know, moves that way. There's also other research that suggests that people with a positive attitude have always had a positive attitude. So I think of one example, you know, there was a very famous study of identical twins separated at birth that you guys may be familiar with. They basically measure their job satisfaction, and no matter what the job, what the salary, where it was, blue collar, white collar, doesn't matter the company, large or small, they, you know, identical twins separated at birth report statistically identical levels of job satisfaction. So what that suggests, certainly doesn't prove it, but what it suggests is that attitude and a positive disposition about what you're doing tends to be born, not learned. Of course, there are exceptions and influences, but, you know, if you believe that research, which we do, you know, it supports a theory that screening for people with a positive attitude will put you on a better path to finding better people in general. I mean, intuitively, we want positive people in the workplace, but I think take that next step. Actively listen for positive storytelling in your interview process. People that reflect negatively about bad experiences tend to be less optimistic and have a more negative attitude in general than people who say, you know, I had this really crappy experience, but I learned from it, and, you know, life goes on. That kind of language is a positive predictor.
Nice. Adam, what should we stop doing in the hiring process?
This is a great question. Stop asking dumb questions. I mean, you know, please, you know, your interview question, unless you really know what it's measuring, you know, stop asking people how many, you know, pieces of elbow macaroni fit into a jar, or if you were a sports car, what color would you be, or what kind of car would you be? You think you're measuring something, but really you're not, and I, you know, what I find is that what we find, those kind of questions, you know, the results of what that predicts is a completely uncorrelated scatter plot of maybe, you know, maybe if I'm a red Ferrari, I'm going to be better at sales, but, you know, maybe I can be a minivan and be great too. You know, it doesn't matter. That stuff doesn't matter. What matters is you know what your question's measuring, and you ask it the same way every time and interpret it the same way every time. Make sure it's related, and, you know, don't ask dumb questions. My favorite story, I mean, you might as well do it. A very good friend of mine who's got a business in Perth, Australia, does, which is he takes a stack of resumes on his desk, he'll print them all out, flip through the top half, and throw them in the trash because he doesn't want any unlucky people working for him. I mean, literally, is his process. You know, that works, I guess, you know. I mean, this is the world we live in. But he swears by it, you know.
Well, some analyst out there can probably make that statistically significant some way, somehow. Who knows? It's data, right? So that is funny. So, Adam, here's the flip side of that. So if you've got one... You've got one question. Everybody out there, you're like, okay, you've got one question to ask. What is the one question you would ask every time you interviewed to try and get the most you could out of that one question?
My favorite question in the world, and I, you know, props to Margot Bale, our product director, listening back at home today for coming up with this one and measuring it. What is the biggest misperception people have of you? It's my absolute favorite question, and asked at the right time in an interview. I mean, what you should get, you know, it's over the course of an interview, you have done a bunch of them, people listening, you've done the interview, you develop, a pro and con column in your head. And in the con column are things like, this person seems a little less confident than I'd like, or they're a little shy, or, man, they're kind of goofy, or they, you know, this person is a little boisterous. Ask this question, and I promise you, the answer will either shatter what you were thinking or confirm some of your suspicion, and it will always be one of those two things. There's no middle ground here. You know, so you'll ask somebody, what's the biggest misperception people have of you? I mean, they've never been asked that question before. And inevitably, yeah, go ahead.
Adam, what's the biggest misperception that people have of you?
That's a great question. Thank you for flipping that back on me. Let me think about that for a second. I want to confirm this when I'm back at the office. You know, this is funny given the venue. I talk with a certain degree of certainty when I have an opinion that what I say is a fact I believe as a fact, and really I tend to be pretty assertive with opinions. And so I can tend to crowd out other opinions in the team I'm working in if I'm not careful, because I'm so forceful with my idea. Because I state it as this is a gospel truth, when really what I'm saying is, here's what I think about this, give me some feedback. And, you know, if your interview, I mean, by the way, I make a pretty terrible employee these days, but, you know, if I'm interviewing for a position, I'm saying things, the interviewer is probably thinking, this guy thinks he knows everything or something about everything, but really what I'm saying is I'm inviting you to challenge what I'm saying. I'm throwing this out here. I want you to fight with me a little bit. And it's more my personality type. But I want you to give it back to me. Tell me I'm wrong. I'm not telling you this is the way it is so you believe it and then go skulk off in the corner and do what I said. I want you to tell me I'm full of BS and here's why. And here's data to prove it. And that it's just the style, but that would be a misperception.
Good answer. We got about 2 minutes left. Where are you going to be at the first part of the year here? Out and about conferences, you speaking, what do you got going on?
Yeah, we've got this is a busy year for our organization. I'll be at the International Franchise Association annual conference in Vegas in a couple of weeks. A non-HR show for sure, but we are a good fit for multi-site enterprises like franchise systems, so we've got a lot of traction in that market. Of course, we'll do the regional SHRMs. We'll be at SHRM in, this year. We'll be, which is in Chicago, so we're not going too far. HR Tech later in the year. A whole bunch of regional SHRMs and then, you know, industry-specific conferences. We'll probably do 15 or so presentation or speaking opportunities or being exhibitors. So we're really excited. This will be it's a big year for our industry, and we're excited to be washing through it as a new entrant.
Perfect. One last question. Where can people connect with you, and then we're going to roll on out?
Yeah, follow us at hireology.com/blog. We've got the best marketing team on the planet. They put great content out there. We do goofy videos. We try and be educational. You can connect with me on Twitter at adrobins, A-D-R-O-B-I-N-S, or arobinson@hireology.com email, and I will get back to anyone who wants to talk.
Right on. Adam, good hearing your voice again. Good conversation. Folks, we're out of here.